It's really nice taking in this audience. Good to be together and to be together with Rabbeinu Moreno Art Green. We had a very warm visit with at Maya's place, some of you may remember, back in December. We had a book launching then for the Hasidic anthology that Art and his friend Evan Maya put together. And here it is, just half a year later, and two new books have appeared. One itsy-bitsy book that is chock full of really precise, tasty little things that kind of hit the mark, called 10 Best Ideas of Judaism. And another huge, substantial retrospective on Art's life's work, kind of coming from two directions and putting them together. One, historical scholarship, the Jewish tradition, rabbinic, Kabbalistic, and especially Hasidic, especially classical Hasidism, the first few generations. And the second, what Art calls theology, I might prefer to call it spiritual teaching. You know, what do we do with this? How do we live this? And some of the pieces really fusing the two of them together. So there was actually a book launching at Hartman last week on Wednesday, but it was basically for the people in the Hartman family. So I said to Art, can we have an evening for the Hevra, for the spiritual community, the Jewish spiritual community, meaning the self-selecting, whoever wants to show up, but for us. And Art agreed, and it came together, and Levi agreed to participate and offer a Kol HaNeshama, and it felt right to invite Rav Rutz, also, who leads the Jewish renewal services often in the basement here. And
youth center, not basement.
we're the young side of the family. Got it.
Tell me about it.
Yeah.
We're the Mimamakim community.
Yeah. I guess we're the Shir Hamalo.
Yes.
Well, let me say a word. It's obvious to most of us, but not to everybody in this room. Baruch Hashem, the south end of Jerusalem has been a home to all kinds of, what should we call it, experiments? No, all kinds of blossoming.
Interesting,
blossoming,
unconventional.
Of new Jewish expressions, and began with the cornerstone of Kol HaNeshama, back when there was a...
30 years ago.
30 years ago, yeah, and even before. The famous Simchas Torah. I wasn't there when...
29 years ago.
Somebody objected to women having hakafot, and instead of fighting him, Levi went and chilled the guy out, and Teddy Kollek heard about it and said, what do you need? And he said, well, you're not serious. I need a building. He said, well, I give you a small building and a good piece of land, and here we are. So Baruch Hashem, and since then, many, many, many other manifestations of Jewish spirituality have been blossoming in this part of the country, including Nava Tehillah. Ruth and her husband Michael studied with my teacher Zalman Schachter for a very significant period of time, and Ruth came back the rabbi, and lots of wonderful things have been happening. Most of you know about this, but for those who wish to follow through on the things discussed tonight, there's this shul, I'm starting a Reb Nachman class on Tuesday night, and any of you interested in doing some deep spiritual study together, you're most welcome. We'll have flyers, and I'll have lots of books for sale, including the two books being featured. And I just want to say I'm very grateful to be here. When I was thinking about the subject for tonight, I thought to myself, well, this can be applied from two ways. Jewish spirituality, Judaism is a spiritual path, postmodern world. There are those of us for whom Judaism is pachot yoter muvan meilav. It's of course we're Jewish and this is what we're doing. And the question then becomes, how can we make that more of a spiritual path? For some of us, the spiritual path is the thing that's clear and taken for granted. And the question then becomes, how can I include Jewish expression as part of my spiritual life in an authentic way? I expect that we'll be touching on both of those this evening. So I'm very happy to pass the microphone over to my old buddy, Levi Kelman, and we'll take it from there.
Baruchim Abayim, welcome to everyone. About a year ago, we gathered here, right after Reb Zalman died, and I want to welcome Devorah, Solomon's sister, who's here. And sorry. And Solomon spoke here numerous times, and when thinking about what it means to go out on a spiritual path, I'm humbled by the incredible gift that I got when I was at rabbinical school at the Jewish Theological Seminary, which doesn't exactly count as developing my spiritual path, but I was able to supplement my years at the seminary going to Philadelphia, where for some part of it on a weekly basis, Art, out of incredible generosity, agreed to teach me on a weekly basis, and then we would have dinner, and we'd walk around the corner, and we'd study with Zalman. And it was an incredible experience. Art and I would pick a safer semester. I remember we did Tolat Yaakov and Maori Naim.
And I'm still teaching the same thing.
Until you learn it, you're going to keep teaching it. With Zalman, what I remember is we would go into his living room, and often he would close his eyes, spin around the room, pick a book at random, open it at random, and that's what we would study with him.
The I Ching method.
Right. And, so that wasn't so systematic, that learning, to say the least. And I remember once Zalman had a breakfast meeting with Reb Shlomo in New York, and he asked me if I would. Bob Dylan told me I shouldn't name drop so much. Zalman asked me if I would drive him from Philadelphia to New York Lemacharat on the next day. And so I borrowed a car, and we drove up, and I remember Zalman offered to pay for gas. You know, it was such a mensch on that level. And instead, I handed him a tape recorder, and I said, no, for the whole ride, you have to sing into this tape recorder so I can learn new nigunim. And he did. Zalman knew that my grandfather and great-grandfather were rabbeim in the chatzer of the youngest son of Israel of Rizhin. So that's my Hasidic lineage. So he sang a lot of Rizhiner nigunim, and I wanted to start the evening with one of those. And every time Zalman would be here, I would always sing this nigun. And it's based on two shepherds calling across to each other from the pastures of Galicia, I guess. And of course, that's a metaphor for our yearning, I would say, for each other in our spiritual path and our yearning for God. So the nigun goes like this.
Ay, 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 ay
The microphone to Art. I have to apologize, Meirosh, the good news and the bad news of being a congregational rabbi. We have a meeting tonight to plan for the Yamim HaNoraim, so maybe I'll pick your brain tonight before the meeting, and that's at 7:30, so I'm going to excuse myself while you're all still hanging out, but I'm with you till my meeting begins. Bevakasha, Art.
Hey, the Yamim HaNoraim are coming already?
Yeah.
Rabbi is running.
Yeah.
Erev Tov, everybody. It's great to be here. Thank you, Yaakov, for arranging this, and thank you, Levi, for hosting us, and great to be back at Kol Neshama and look around and see lots and lots of old friends from lots and lots of different places, and some new friends and some people I'd like to get to know, so that's great. And most of this evening is supposed to be a dialogue. The three of us are supposed to talk, and you guys are going to ask questions or engage in conversation, and then we'll open it up, but I'll say just a little bit at the beginning kind of to get us going. So this book, the bigger book Yaakov talked about, is called The Heart of the Matter. It's a collection of essays I wrote over the years. There are a few new pieces in there. There's one big piece that appeared only in Hebrew previously, and now it's in English. And it combines history and theology at the same time, or history and spiritual teaching. I'm happy with that tikkun from Yaakov. And they asked me what to call the book. And I said, let's call it The Heart of the Matter. Levainyan, what's it all about? What have I been trying to do all these years? What's the project? Excuse me. One part of the project in the book is building the bridge between Jewish scholarship and Jewish spiritual life. I was trained to be a Jewish scholar, studying the Jewish past and writing articles about the history of Hasidism or the history of Jewish mysticism. But the project was always a personal one. I was attracted to studying this because I fell in love with it when I was 20 years old, and because it was the spiritual language that spoke to me, because in some ways it saved Judaism for me, and it saved my soul from all kinds of terrible things. And so I was in love with the material. At the same time, I was trying to be a critical scholar of it. As I made the transition, I'm a person who three times left the university world for small, intimate communities of rabbis and their students. My wife, Kathy, used to say that there are some guys who get a little red sports car every few years after a certain age, and Green gets a little red rabbinical school. Red in that sentence refers mostly to the color ink in the ledger books of those rabbinical schools, but a little bit to the politics of the students attracted to them as well. But it's
and been, also everybody's well-read there.
Yes. So. But it's been a wonderful, wonderful journey, and I feel very, very privileged to be teaching present rabbis and future rabbis. It's really the work I was made to do, and feel very, very happy and fulfilled doing it. But in a broader sense, I want to say this. The project is really creating what I call a seeker-friendly Judaism. Judaism is a tradition that, in some people's readings of it, doesn't have much room for seekers. We live after Matan Torah. The answers to the questions are all there. They're given. You can look them up. We have a good book called The Set Table, the Shulchan Aruch. You can find out what you're supposed to do, and that's what Judaism is. So I have very long been attracted to the figure of Avraham Avinu. I want a Yiddishkeit that somehow belongs to the children of Avraham Avinu, who was a seeker, of course. The whole thing is based on we are followers of a seeker. Remember, he was not, I like to say, Yeletov Yerushalayim or Yeletov Ur Kasdim, who did just what his parents wanted him to do. He was an iconoclast, and after breaking the idols, he went out and sought and tried to work out one form of worship and then another. He was a person with more questions than answers. My own midrash says he went back and forth to the Negev, which means he had dry periods in his life. Sometimes he was able to dig well, sometimes he wasn't. Halach v'nasoa anegba. And he was a person who wound up at the end of his life also still with questions, still with challenges. Still with calling out to the Rebbeinu Shloim, L'mashofet kol haaretz lo yaseh mishpat, will the judge of all the earth not do justice? He was there, after all, by the way, to save the lives of people you might call Palestinians in Sodom. And he was arguing with God as much as he was a lover of God. He was Abraham Ohavi, but he was also Abraham Ohavi, who also has the nerve to argue with me. His grandson got the name Yisrael as a person who wrestled with God, who struggled with God. And that name Yisrael, I think, belongs to all the strugglers, to all the people who are still involved in that wrestling match. Yaakov Avinu also, I think, like Avraham Avinu, yes, it's a wrestling match, but when these two guys spend all night wrestling together, you wonder where wrestling ends and lovemaking begins. Are you sure? That famous scene you may remember in the old film of Sons and Lovers, where you don't quite know whether it's a wrestling match or whether it's something else. And I like to think the Yaakov and the Malach are involved in something like that, because that's what our relationship with the Rabbi Nishvel is. It's wrestling, and it's making love, and it's being intimate, and it's being challenging, and it's fighting for survival, and it's fighting finally to get a blessing in that struggle for survival, and all of the above. So I want a Yiddishkeit that welcomes such people, that welcomes people who are in that tradition of Avraham Avinu and Yaakov Avinu. It seems pretty obvious there should be room for them. But I found there wasn't room for them in the American synagogue, in the American liberal synagogue, because it was too stilted and formal and essentially disinterested in real spiritual growth. And there wasn't room for them in the Orthodox community because there wasn't openness to that kind of challenge and question. So in old, wonderful, sissy old friends from Chavurat Shalom, in creating the Chavura and creating everything I've created since, which is sort of in the image of the Chavura. By the way, Zalman got an honorary degree from us at Hebrew College about 2 weeks before his passing. And he talked there about the continuity of the Chavura tradition, that the Hebrew College Rabbinical School is the latest incarnation of the Chavura tradition. He said it more directly than I would dare to say it. And it was very, very well received. So in doing all of that, that's a question, creating a Jewish home for seekers, and allowing seekers not only to be individual seekers, but to build their own communities and to find room for those communities, and then have those communities spread out and influence the broader community. And I think in the 50 years of this project, a little bit of it has succeeded. Here and there, we have some real impact on the community, and of course, some impact on the lives of individuals. And much of it's been through writing, because it's something I like to do, and some people tell me I do well. You know that famous line that Gershom Scholem quotes by Pinchas Karetzer. Pinchas Karetzer said, "I thank God that my neshama came into the world after the Zohar was revealed. Well, the Zohar hat mich behalten bei Yiddishkeit, because the Zohar kept me a Jew." Which means somehow, if not for the Zohar, he wouldn't have found himself in Judaism. I feel that way about the Hasidic masters, that had they come into the world without them, I wouldn't have found my way to stay within the confines of Judaism. I would have wandered off to something else, something more spiritually open. And I like to think that some of my writing has done that for some next generation people who find their way into the doorway of Judaism through some of the things I write and through some of the things I teach. And if I do, that's you can't ask for any greater privilege. So that's what I do. That's what the project is about. And everything else, in some ways, is a commentary on and an expansion of that. So let me just stop there and toss it out to the two of you and make this a conversation. Thank you all. Thank you all for being here.
So I'm going to ask a question. It's for us and maybe also for people attending here. What is juicy for you? Mm-hmm. That is both spiritual and Jewish. Where is the juice? I said Bofen Klali, you said Hasidut.
So I'm not saying Bofen Klali, what is generally juicy for you. You know, you said Hasidut, you said the Zohar, I think it's probably, you know, Nigunim. But in the spirit of the 10 best things, you know,
yes.
Let's choose one thing of the many things that you find rejuvenate you in your excitement to be here as a Jew who is also spiritual.
I want to add to that question, and since so much of being on a spiritual path, I think, is about finding the right spiritual teachers, maybe who were the teachers who helped you find the juice along the way?
Well, you answered the question already. The juice is in my Talmidim. I have been blessed with having wonderful, wonderful talmidim over the years. I think I've treated them well, and that keeps them around, it brings them around. But I've just been blessed with wonderful, intelligent, open-hearted. I've attracted people in some ways who were like myself, which is to say people who have been on the edge of the university world and then left. But I've also attracted people with very open hearts. Can I say something very personal? I think I became who I am because I was a very wounded child. My mother died when I was very young, and that was a wound that never healed. There are some people who have wounds in childhood, and that makes them build very tough shells around themselves and makes them very hard. But there are some of us who don't succeed in building those shells, and we walk around with an unusual degree of vulnerability, especially among men, because men are not so easy, not so comfortable with vulnerability. And I think I was always one of those people, and I've attracted people like that in some ways. People have a lot of open-heartedness and a lot of room for love, but also a deep passion for the life of the spirit that somehow fills that ultimately empty space. And if I look at my Talmidim and say, what do they have in common? What brought us together? I think there is a lot, not everybody, but there is a lot of that. There is a lot of people with open and semi-broken hearts. And you know the famous Hasidic saying, "Nishdu as a ganze zach v'yatze broken hearts, en lecha davar shalem kilev shavur." There's nothing as always a broken heart. I don't know why I said it in all three languages, but I think there is something. There is something there about what our chavura of intimacy has been about. But the biggest juice is Talmidim, is relationship with Talmidim, of course. Yes, I love studying Zohar. I've now joined Danny Matt in his Amud Yomi studying Zohar. I've never studied that way in my life, daf al daf. But now I'm sort of with that program, and I love it. And certain Hasidic books, I'm in love with the Moreh Nayim these years, and still am. I'm now negotiating with the Yale Judaica series, and hope they will publish a very fancy English edition of it. My teachers, I was an American Jewish kid who was just the right age to gain maximum benefit from the wonderful generation of Jewish thinkers and scholars and teachers whom Hitler cast up on American shores. When I was a kid in Newark, New Jersey, the rabbi was Joachim Prinz from Berlin. When I became too frum for him, his brother-in-law Max Grunwald from Mannheim was the rabbi. I went off to college when I was 16 and studied with Nachum Glatzer and Alexander Altman and Yisrael Efros, who I think had been in America longer. But my teachers in general philosophy were Herbert Marcuse and Aaron Gurvich. At Brandeis, you could get the most middle European education in North America for a long period of time, and I did. And then I went to the seminary and had the great privilege of being Heschel's private student. So they were all Europeans. They were all Eastern Europeans who had been taught in Germany. I didn't take anybody serious who didn't have a European accent. It was partly, by the way, why Mordechai Kaplan's thought never really appealed to me. He was too American. I don't mean just accent, of course. He was an American pragmatist, sociological. That's right. And it didn't have the depth and passion of Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and the existential crisis after Hegel and where do we go and so on and the broken tablets and the loneliness of Kafka. And I think I read Nietzsche in six different college courses, and then discovering a Sartre and Camus and sort of the existential crisis, and then Rosenzweig and Buber coming in, creating an existential Judaism, which was a response to it. That was my world. It was sort of very Middle European. And as I say, it was a great privilege to study with those teachers. And in some ways, I feel that I am a conduit from that generation of my teachers to people who didn't have the privilege of knowing them. I want to say that David Weiss Halivni is my last living teacher. He's here in Jerusalem. He's very, very special to me. Partly because when I was a kid at Ramah, in 15 years old, my Hebrew was quite good already, but I'd never opened Daf Gemara because I didn't come from a day school. And the camp librarian that summer said, "Come on, I'll teach you a Daf Gemara." His name was David Weiss Halivni. Oh, and so we've had a very special, close relationship ever since.
So I'm very struck by the image of your vulnerability and your mom's death, and here we are between Shavasar Batamuz and Likrat Tisha B'Av, which is kind of a vulnerable place for the Jewish people, and you're talking about all these teachers who fled the Churban. And on the other hand, American New Age renewal, certainly the stereotype, I'd say unfair stereotype, but still there, of focusing much more on Simcha, which is, I think, the first of your entries in your book. So I'm very struck by, in the 10 best ideas of Judaism, the first one is Simcha, is joy. And that strikes me as a kind of an interesting tension that you carry with you.
Yes, I wanted Simcha as the first one because so many people think religion is just about burdening you with guilt. So many people think religion is just something depressing, and who wants it? People who walk into synagogue once a year on Yom Kippur and think it's all about sin. And, I'm attracted to Hasidism because of Avodat Hashem B'Simcha. That's what it's all about. Serving God is something supposed to be uplifting and transformative and make you ecstatically happy. You know, now these days there's a great revival of Mussar going on. And although I think the American Mussar teachers who are doing that are very careful and balanced, I do not like the Mussar tradition because it was about sort of oppressing people, beating people over the head with guilt, and trying to change behavior by shaming them and by making them feel burdened. And Hasidut did not do that. Hasidut, you read again and again in Levi Yitzchak and other people about two kinds of teachers. One is a mochiach who tries to scare people, and the other is one who tells people about how high their soul is and how great their potential to be close to God is, and that's the Hasidic way. Heschel, by the way, understood that very well. You want to understand something about Hasidim and Misnagid, look at the extensive treatment of sin and tshuva in Soloveitchik and the almost total absence of that theme in Heschel. Just doesn't deal with it. He talks, sin is not ontological, he says in a couple of places, and is not interested in the question of sin. And that's because he is a neo-Hasidic thinker, even though he doesn't quite call himself that. So that's why it's starting with Simcha, very important to me. And that's the kind of religiosity I want my students and graduates to give to people, to create for people.
What did you find are the best ways to do Besimcha?
To be Besimcha within a Jewish life.
You know better than I do.
That's why.
There's music and there's dance, but there's really just a dibuk haverim, kind of close relationships with real friends to whom you can open your heart and with whom you can talk. I think to me, in some ways, that's the greatest source of simcha is that kind of intimacy and that kind of sense of building things together. And I remember conversations looking at Richie and conversations back 50 years ago about how do we create community, and coming to understand that you create community by doing things together, by building things together, not by talking about what community is. So I think that the simcha of a project, the simcha of building, I see Frankie is here too, building a new institution, building a new rabbinical school, and the effort of coming together and saying, what's this going to be, defining it, creating something together, is really, for me, in some ways, the happiest kind of thing to do it. You must have felt that in creating the congregation.
Yeah, it's an amazing feeling to feel something coming together. I'm kind of intrigued by, as you started each of your projects, how much did you have a sense of where you were going? How much were you pulled along spontaneously, and how much did you have really definite, clearly defined images and goals of what you were trying to do?
I never thought of myself as an institution builder. My loyalties are really to ideas and people, not to institutions. I was always very suspicious of institutions, some institutions that we share in our background and others. I was a kind of iconoclast with regard to institutions. That I have wound up somehow being involved with the building of institutions has always turned out to be a big surprise to me. So it was not, there was a strong institutional goal, this is what I want this institution to become, but they were all a kind of incarnation of this notion of a seeker-friendly Judaism, of creating a home for Jewish seekers. And we are going to do that. We are going to model that. We are going to teach rabbis who will model that and take it out there. The idea of concentric circles, of building the circles wider and wider, but always starting with something small enough to be authentic and close and having a really powerful impact on people. And then some of them, not all of them, of course, some of them will create a wider circle and take that circle somewhere else and shape it a little bit differently so that it will spread out through the people, through the Jewish community and beyond. I think that was the kind of model. No, there wasn't a model of this is what this institution is going to look like in 50 years, and I'm doing the strategic planning to make it that.
But an image of what you wanted your Talmidim to be like, to do.
Yes, very much so. And that model, I would say, which was my model, combining what I think is serious learning with that kind of spiritual openness, and that combination of creating a Judaism that is both spiritually rich and attractive and intellectually honest. I have tried to model intellectual honesty to my students. Don't go out and preach and teach things that you really, b'chadrei chadarim, don't believe, or can't find a way to interpret that you feel honestly committed to. And that may be a matter of parshanut. It may be a matter of saying, in what sense do I believe this? How do I believe this? How can I use this term? I was telling the group that Danny was part of at Hartman that about my resignation from the prayer book commission of the Reconstructionist movement. I was in charge of the Hebrew text of the new prayer book. And I walked out in the middle of our discussion of Shabbat Shacharit, because Mordechai Kaplan had written the previous prayer book of the movement. We were redoing it. And we came to the phrase, Ushne luchot avanim horid biyado v'chatu behem shmirat Shabbat. And they said, we're Reconstructionists, we don't believe in that. And I said, don't be ridiculous. It's not that I believe in it literally, it's not that I think that's the way it happened. That's the way you say it in Jewish. That's the Jewish language for revelation. Even though revelation, I believe, is an internal event of the spirit, is not a physical event from the mountaintop, that's the Jewish language for it. And preserving that language has been terribly important for me. Even, of course, reinterpreted. Of course, not literal. But modeling to students that they do that they understand the richness of that language and the love of that language, while at the same time being able to talk about it in an intellectually honest way, and yet retaining that power.
You're mentioning the Shnei Luchot. I'm just aware that I have to leave, so that's why I'm
hogging
a little.
Express yourself.
I learned so much over the years from you, but when I think of the teaching that I got from you that I quote the most often, I kind of want to make you guess, but I won't. That's exactly right.
Wow.
Well, obviously I gave you a good
name. Yeah.
So from Menachot, right?
Brachot. I think it's Brachot. Maybe not.
Yeah. The image that the fragments of the first tablets are in the Aron HaBrit with the whole set, and the idea that that we don't have the whole truth and that we need others, and now I'm not sure what I learned from you and what I already made my own and became my own preaching, teaching, and how since we only have pieces, we're compelled to find other people who also have the pieces, and somehow all together we can kind of put together a very fragmented and incomplete puzzle to get to our version of the truth. So that's a teaching that stayed with me in a very, very profound way.
The Gemara is Luchot v'Shivrei Luchot Munachim Ayu Ba'aron, both the whole and the broken tablets when they are on. The Gemara says it, by the way, in a beautiful context. It says, be aware to respect an elderly sage who has forgotten his Torah, because both whole and broken tablets were placed in the ark. It's just magnificent use of that image. And I'm very, very aware of that these days, as you know. And then I went on to say that I think that this is the what piece you heard. I think the Shivrei Luchot were placed there for our generation, which is no longer capable of learning from old tablets, that we need to pick up fragments and put them together and make our own mosaic, put our floors together. And
absolute truth is something that's just not attainable for us.
And I said that my non-orthodoxy is also, I couldn't be an orthodox Freudian or an orthodox Marxist or an orthodox Hegelian, because the grand system where everything fits together and there are answers to all the questions doesn't work for me in that very basic sense, that sense that there are bits of truth you could find and you'll put it together and it's imperfect and you'll, yes, learn something from somewhere else and somebody else. That somehow is a model of truth I found more accessible.
I remember learning it from you in the context of how we should relate to other Jews, and I know I've used a lot in my interfaith work, an image of needing other religious teachers and believers to learn my own truth from them, and it's really a profound teaching for me.
To earn it back, sometimes you have to hear it said back in somebody else's language, and then you say, "Oh yes, we knew that, of course, but we hadn't been able to say it to her in a way that really opened us up." Yeah, yeah.
So I want to kamocha, like you, I'm also ani chotet b'tamidei rabbanot, and like, you know, there is a great it's really wonderful to be teaching rabbinical students and rabbis and buildings of Jewish institutions, but in a way I want to take it into the people sitting here. Some of the people here are indeed rabbis and buildings of institutions, but some other people here who are I would say seekers or seeking to be seekers and Jewish, and they're not necessarily Jewish professionals. The katan of bagadol, you know, there's artists and social workers and people who have all kind of balabatim. And I would like kind of to zoom into, as I said, Rachel b'tchaktana, on some things that would be food for people here, that's something that we can chew on it. And I would like to invite you to speak about things that you say in your Torah and your books, which are not general by now. I mean, you were, when you started, you were like a groundbreaker. And now a lot of the things that you said in the beginning are kind of pretty mekubal on the people sitting here, the pachot.
At least.
So, but I wondered if there's things that you would, you know, you bring up some people who haven't read the books yet. There would be a dvarim yotzei, the things that would challenge people here, maybe. Lo shamanu, we might not agree. You know, I'd like to have some choser nachat.
Okay. Well, let me say first that Judaism is a household of religion. It's meant to be for householders.
Yeah.
You know, going back to Zalman, whom we started with, Zalman tried to interest both my future wife and myself in what he thought was going to be a Jewish kind of monastic community. He dreamed, his original dream of B'nai Or was a sort of Jewish monastery for married families who would live together in a very intense communal life. That was the original pattern. My wife and I were introduced by him in that context. 47 years later, here we are. But Judaism really isn't that. It really is meant for householders, not for Nazirim, not for people in monastic communities. And so it's got to be accessible. There've got to be little things that are accessible, and short things that are accessible, and things that are doable. I'm now in a new campaign. I want to tell you about my latest campaign. It won't be as controversial as you would like, but it is a new campaign. And that is, I'm trying to revive a custom among Jews, an ancient custom that has been forgotten. And that is the reciting of what's called the Ma'amad every day at the end of Tefillah. The Ma'amad is the reciting of the days of creation at the end of the Tefillah each day. On Sunday, when you finish Tefillah, you say, Bereshit Bara Elohim. On Monday, you say, Yikavu Hamayim. On Tuesday, you say Tatshe Haaretz. And so on Friday night, when you come back, when you say Vayechulu Hashamayim Vaaretz, you're completing the cycle again. That custom, which is already mentioned in Masechet Ta'anit, was revived in the 16th, 17th century, but of course they had to add things to it. While you're saying something from the Torah, from Bereshit, why don't you say a Pasuk from Nevi'im? Why don't you say a Mishnah and a Gemara? And it got so heavy that it got dropped. But I say this, I want to revive this custom of saying the days of creation each day, because I believe that the most important task of religion in this century is going to be reminding us that we live in a created world, however we understand that, which is to say religion will have to be marshaled to change the way we live on this planet and the relationship we have to the natural world. And if we can't rediscover the sacred within the natural and act that way and change the way we live, we're not going to survive. And that's everything else, even the Middle Eastern conflict, everything else diminishes in the face of that challenge. And I think to recite the days of us, as I've been doing it for the past year, and now I'm getting my students and disciples and other people to do it. I'm announcing it here and starting this campaign, Belev HaOlam, Belev HaOlam HaYehudi, at least sort of here in Jerusalem, but it's going to go out in internet blast in the next few weeks to very large numbers of people. The idea being, of course, not just that you make it a ritual, but that each day you think about it, that on Mondays you think about what are we going to do about the poisoning of the oceans, and on Tuesdays you think about plant life, and on Thursdays you think about birds and fish, and how are we going to change our lives and the way we relate to the natural world.
Well, so should we do solar energy on the first day or the fourth day?
Well, I think the fourth day. The first day is just remembering creation, just remembering that we are a people who have this idea that this is a created world. It's enough to digest for a Sunday morning over bagels, of course, when you have to decide about the lox. So I think that's what I'm saying. I think we have to join with the Pope, whom I congratulate greatly, in being a kind of spiritual vanguard in seeing this transformation of consciousness. I think that's the most important task that religion is going to have in this century, and we have to begin marshaling ourselves actively toward it. So for people who daven, think about trying the ma'amad, see what it's like. For people who don't pray every day, I would say try it anyway. Reciting the days of creation every day, reciting those three verses or so every day, maybe you can add just a Shema Yisrael line to them, and there you have the beginning of a Jewish daily spiritual practice that is also environmental and also about the real issues of the world, because the spiritual issues have to be connected to the real things that we face as human beings. And there's no bigger and more spiritual one than that, I would say. So that's a good starting place.
Since we are here in Yerushalayim, again, between Shabbat Sar B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av.
You want me to tell you how bad things are?
Well, I was going to start this way, say, even though we really have to wait a bit before we get to Nechemta, and I really wanted to hear some Nechemta, but I'm always struck by your love of Hebrew. I'd like you to talk about your relationship, feelings, Jerusalem, Baca, Jerusalem, Israel, Israel diaspora, if you could just sort of reassociate on that.
Well, I've loved Baca for a long time, but I must say I've been staying in Old Katamon for the last three visits, and my loyalties aren't switching completely, but Old Katamon is very charming.
You know, Baca is gematria for Gan Eden.
I didn't know. Well, read Ari Shavit in today's Haaretz. What can I tell you? I love being here. I have more people to talk to in this city, of course, than Kol HaOlam Kulo combined, and that's wonderful. And so the number of times you'll see me in coffee shops and in intense conversations with wonderful people here is just magnificent. I'm now on a matkonet, on a schedule of two visits a year, because I'm teaching in a program that's going to have me here twice a year, and I'm thrilled about that. If I were 20 years younger and my wife were healthy, I would think again about the Aliyah question. I don't know what I'd decide, but I certainly would reconsider it. Because of the wonderful things people I know and love have built and created here, and I feel that the whole thing is wrapped in a terrible shroud of tragedy, because I fear that that we have allowed so-called facts to happen on the so-called ground, that our generation has failed miserably in its leadership, that it's on our watch, that a certain kind of attitude toward Jewish exclusivity and Jewish power has taken over, and I don't know if it's repairable anymore, and even saying I don't know devastates me, but I think that's where we are. I am still a firm believer in Shtei Medinot L'Shnei Amim. Doesn't that sound nice? But is it people say to me, come on, you really still think that's possible? And I don't have a good answer to them. I always have an imaginary conversation with one of my favorite of our graduates, very, very bright, wonderful young man, who's just gone to work full-time for Jewish Voice for Peace, which is the BDS outfit in Washington, D.C. And in this semi-real and semi-imaginary conversation, he says to me, okay, Green, you've been against the settlement project since 1968. What have you done about it? I can say, I signed petitions, and I did this, and I bet, you know. And what have you accomplished? Give my generation a chance to do something differently. I don't have a good answer to him. I'm completely opposed to what he does, completely opposed, because I think it's counterproductive. It will only arch the backs and make things worse. But I don't feel that's a good enough answer in that imaginary conversation, because I feel that we were, whatever we are, maybe we have been somehow Jewish leaders for the past 40 years, and he didn't scream loud enough. And this is in some ways a failure on our watch. And I don't think it's over, but I think we have a lot of responsibility for not having spoken up louder and done more. How's that?
And diaspora.
And diaspora, sometimes I come here and I say, what wonderful, interesting Yiddishkeit is being created here. The hope I see here is so much more willingness to cross Dati Chiloni lines than I used to. Interesting people from the Dati world somehow having either discovered Indian religion and that's led them to a new openness because they too go to India, or maybe it's having read certain things, maybe even some of my work, that the recovery of interest in Heschel here is very exciting, Dror Bundy and the wonderful work he's done. So I see openings here that are very exciting and very creative, but I also see us creating a Judaism in America that's in small circles, very alive and very renewing, and something that most Israelis wouldn't understand at all and wouldn't be able to fit into any categories they have done. When my book, Seek My Face, Bakshu Panei, came out in Hebrew, most Israelis didn't know what to do with it. Ma'u dati u lo dati u chassid, aval hu lo ma'amin baze, aval hu. I didn't fit into the boxes. I think that's now changing. Radical Judaism is being rewritten for the Hebrew. I'm going to come out next year, and I'm going to do a big campaign here, and I hope it'll mean something.
Who's rewriting it?
I've rewritten a lot of it, but I have a wonderful translator named Yigal Harmelin Moria, and it's really been a cooperative project between us, and I'm very excited about that, and it's been really rewritten for an Israeli audience. So there are good things happening in both places. There's not enough communication. I meet all kinds of Israelis who discovered Judaism when they came to the Tfutzot. That's very interesting to see. I follow lots of things going on in places like Beit Tfilah Yisraelit and all kinds of Israeli rediscovery project, rediscovery of Judaism projects, and those are wonderful things, and you've both had big hands in those, obviously, and kol hakavod lachem for doing so, but there's still a lot more to be done. And I say, I write in this chapter that Israelis have to realize that American Jews, especially younger generation American Jews, are very, very American, which means are very committed to the project of democracy. Because it's only the project of democracy that really gave us our rights in America. I still grew up at a time when there was anti-Semitism, and you could see it both in public and in private. And the fact of the separation of church and state was what made us mention in America. And we worked very hard on those things. And, you know, we Americans are now living in a society where the racist legacy of our past is hitting us in the face every single week. There's something new in the paper, and we are devastated, I would say, in America, by the realization that this original sin of slavery and racism has never gone away and never been conquered and never been dealt with. And I say to my Israeli friends, unless you deal with it, unless you face it, it's not going to go away. It's going to be coming back 200 years later, hitting you in the face. Look at us. And that's an important lesson to learn.
I would like to open now for questions from the Kahal. I want to invite you to ask questions and not to make speeches. Because it's a hizdamnut to hear from our... This is why we also keep ourselves with questions.
I'm going to excuse myself now. I'm going to meeting. Tada rabba. Thank you all for being here.
Tada rabba. Okay.
So my question pertains to this last topic of democracy and racism. And in what ways does the Torah support democracy and lack of discrimination? And in what ways are there four principles in Torah that actually are antithetical to democracy?
I would say you have to understand that we are engaged in a great battle for the soul of this tradition. And that means how to read the Torah and how to understand the Torah. All sides can quote psukim. That's too easy. I will, of course, tell you lots of things about Ki Gerim Hayitem Beretz Mitzrayim, Vidatem Et Nefesh Ager, and so on. and that has to be about how you treat minorities and oppressed groups in your society and people who feel themselves to be strangers. I can read that, but somebody else can come along. The people in the Kahanist camp can come along and also quote verses. So there are things in the Torah that are very difficult for the people on our side of the street, shall we say. Next week we're going to be reading Parshat Matot, where Moshe has to go back and remember to kill the women and children. Of course, that's there. We know that's there. And when you read those psukim, go back and remember to kill the women and children. You know, all of us Jews shudder. We think of I don't have to tell you what. And so there are hard things in the text. Yes, I have to remember the text was written a very long time ago, and I know that may not be helpful for some people who need to see it as all directly of divine origin. But I have to say that there are things in the text that must have been understood by people who read them a long time ago and needed to hold those views. I had a wonderful moment of dialogue with a fellow named Jim Carroll. James Carroll, he's an American Catholic writer, former priest, wrote a wonderful book called The Sword of Constantine a number of years ago, which was a full acceptance of the anti-Semitic legacy of the church and where anti-Semitism came from and how it already is in the Gospels themselves. And I said to him, Jim, once you realize that hatred of Jews is in the Gospel of John, don't you want to amend the text? Don't you want to take that out of the text? And he said, no, I want it to be there so I can stand up and preach against it. And that was a very important moment for me. Because sometimes I want to take out psukim. Sometimes I want to say, can I accept an aliyah? Can I accept an aliyah in that parsha in Matot and say, Hashem atan lanu Torah temet? Can I do that in good conscience? And I struggle with it, and that goes for certain psukim and vayikra and so on, and other subjects. We could make a long list, I'm afraid, once we open that door. But my list is actually pretty short. The things that really, really offend my spirit. But that it needs to be there so I can stand up and preach against it was a very important thing for me to learn. And that means that our Torah is involved in the process of reinterpretation. Now, I have a very important rule in this. I am a Hasid of Ben Azai, who said to Rabbi Akiva, you remember, Ani Yodea Kval Gadol Mizeh, a greater principle than Ve'avta L'Recha Kamocha is Briat Kol Adam B'Tzelem Elohim. And I take that Klal Gadol to mean that is the most basic teaching of Torah. And anything you find in Torah that doesn't agree with that has to be reinterpreted in terms of it, because that is the Klal Gadol. So I'm not saying democracy or some other word that we learned from the Western world is the Klal Gadol. I'm saying with Ben Azai, the Klal Gadol is Tzelem Elohim. And then you have to ask, how does my reading of this pasuk or that pasuk bring more people into the cloud of Tzelem Elohim, help me to see more people that way, help them to see themselves that way, to recognize the Tzelem Elohim in themselves and in other people. And that's my operating principle for how I begin that process of answering the kind of question you're asking.
Okay, so you can take this already. Please say your name before and where you're from.
My name's Danny and I'm from London. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned before a lot of your teachers, and I wanted to ask you who, aside from those, who were your teachers, especially in the field of spirituality, spiritual practice, but not to tell us who your Hasidic teachers were.
Can you speak a little bit louder? Danny asked about who are the teachers, not just the Hasidic teachers.
I want to know who your spiritual teachers were can you hear me now?
Yes, that's right.
The spirituality were in the Jewish and potentially outside of the Jewish tradition in the 20th and 21st century.
You will not find a very long list. Zalman was very important to me. I did not let Zalman, but I would say about both Zalman and Heschel, I did not let either of them be my Rebbe, but they were both terribly important teachers. My last conversation with Heschel, I said, you know, Professor Heschel, it never quite worked well between us. When I needed a Rebbe, he wanted to be a professor. When I needed a professor, He wanted to be a rebbe. And that was true. I can give you the details, but it's not important. Zalman, in some ways, I forced a friendship out of him that was a little different than what most people had with him, where they wanted his blessings as rebbe, and I wanted his friendship. And we became very, very, very dear friends, and I miss him terribly, which is, when I say friends, it's not to say I didn't learn a tremendous amount from him. Of course I did, but it was within the context somehow of a friendship rather than master-disciple. Because I never let myself have a rebbe, I was too ornery, I guess. I was always nervous about letting myself become a rebbe to anybody. And so for a long time, I struggled with that issue. Would I let people consider me their rebbe? I think at age almost 75, I'm safe enough that I can let myself do that and not run away from it so much. But I did spend a lot of years running away from that relationship. I have done some reading in Western Buddhism and other traditions, but not very much. I have never been a serious practitioner of any of the techniques of any other tradition. For about a year, when I was a rabbinical student, I think, I joined a group called Subud. Some of you may know Subud, an originally Indonesian practice group. I was interested more in the techniques of practice than in the theology, but it became a little too much of a madhouse for me, if you know what the practice is. Very, not important. And I dropped out of that rather quickly after a year. And that was really the only non-Jewish religious practice I engaged in. My work has mostly been internal, and mostly to a very large extent, I am spiritually self-taught. And a lot of it's been trial and error, and a lot of it's been failing. And as Reb Nachman says about his childhood, you fall off the ladder and pick yourself up and begin all over again. And sometimes that can happen more than once a day. And that's a good bit of what I have done. So there isn't a secret list of teachers that I have been keeping from the public.
Would you be willing to share one experiment that you did that you look now and you say didn't work? In Judaism, I'm not talking about revelation.
That's a great question. I have to think for a moment. Ask something else, and I'll come back to it.
Okay. The next person would like to ask a question.
I'd like to know whether you think seriously that there is a future non-orthodoxy in America, and how can that? I don't see it. Maybe you could let us know a little bit more. The orthodox world, especially the more right wing of it, it seems to be thriving. Is there a future for non-orthodoxy?
Well, we're not going anywhere. We're not becoming ultra-Orthodox, and we're not disappearing. We are there. There are some real centers of great vitality within the non-Orthodox world. I don't know why you say that. You have to get to know them and spend some time with them. Go to Romamu in New York and Ikara in Los Angeles, and come to us at the rabbinical school in Boston and a half a dozen other places I can point to where very exciting experimental things are happening. I would say there certainly is a future for that. Now, numerically, we're in decline, no question about it. If I look at the grandchildren of my first cousins, even on the more traditional side of my family, I don't see many Jews left. But that's a result of the number of generations it's now been since the Great Immigration. And those numbers are going to continue to decline. Sometimes they decline through intermarriage, sometimes they decline simply by disappearing into American society. That's called assimilation. And of course it's happening. But there are pockets of energy. There are new community day schools. You can come to the Jewish Community Day School in Boston and see a wonderful group of teachers and students who are taking Jewish life very seriously. You can see things happening musically and artistically that I would say are very exciting in North American Jewish life. Go to a place like Romamu and hear the music there, and you see lots of interesting musical creativity as well. So I would say that there is something condescending about the Orthodox view of the rest of us, which we find annoying. That certainly is there. And, you know, you guys are about to die out. We're about to take over, so goodbye. But that's very much not the case. Now, we don't make babies at the right rate. That's true, certainly. But we have to work on that one.
Say your name first.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can answer this question, but working with feminine and female and masculine energies in the correlation to the tree of life. I mean, I come from a very deep background from Tibetan Buddhism, and I'm kind of trying to heal now my connection to Judaism. And my sense of feeling that maybe I'm wrong is there's a lot of oppression for the femininity.
A lot of
oppression for the femininity. This is my experience. And on the other hand, you try to welcome the shkuna inside the man. And I'm worried also about, you know, sexuality and the walking with feminine, female, and male origins. And whether there's correlation between the tree of life and the chakras, you know, the subtle energy bodies, and the Zohar and the Kabbalah.
You have a long list. Let me start with just a little bit.
He's starting to write the book now.
And maybe Ruth, you want to respond to this too. We cannot be dishonest about the past. Judaism was mostly a tradition, a literary, legal, and theological tradition that was created by men for men. They never expected there would be female readers of the great Jewish books. That's the way it was. And we have to accept that. We want to change it. Of course we want to change it. I'm very proud of the fact that more than half of my rabbinical students are women, and they're going out there and building and creating something. I'm very happy to live in the generation when that revolution happened in Jewish life and to have welcomed that. At the same time, it's not completely easy. The wound that many women feel from the past is still there. The presence of a somewhat strong male leader like myself sometimes scares some women away. You can't have access to that because it's so much a male energy world, and I realize that, and I cannot be somebody other than who I am. But I realize that sometimes that's true, and that's why most of my closest students, have been men rather than women. I think there is somehow fear of approaching that, and that's something I regret very much for a reason I do not understand. In Israel, among the people who study Kabbalah, Hasidut, Jewish spirituality, I would say more than half are women, in both the academic area and even in the personal teaching area. In America, the serious women about Judaism seem to run to Talmud. They believe that Talmud and Halakha will somehow empower them to make changes. And they get doctorates in Talmud and become Talmudists, and I'm frustrated by that fact. I would like them to come study Kabbalah and Hasidut and spirituality. The reconnection of Etz Hadaat and Etz HaChayim is a very important theme in our spiritual lives. We have an intellectuality that is too dry, too disconnected from what the vibrancy of inner spiritual life means. Franz Kafka said once that the reason Adam and Eve were expelled from Gan Eden was not because they ate of Etz Hadaat, but because they didn't connect it to Etz HaChayim. They broke the two trees apart. He couldn't have known, but a Kabbalist named Rabbi Azriel Migerona said that already 700 years before him, but Sholem hadn't even published that manuscript when Kafka was writing, so it's completely independent. This is a very important theme for me. I mentioned it in the introduction to this new book, because I spent years in the university, and I believe in the university world we have precisely that. We have Etz Hadaat, not connected to Etz HaChayim, a dry kind of intellectuality, having lost its love of life. Nobody goes to an American university or the Hebrew university in Jerusalem to become wise. The idea that you seek wisdom in the university seems ridiculous. The university is a very expensive, fancy career training school. Where do you go to seek wisdom? You can go to a Tibetan master, you can go to an ashram, you can go to certain yeshivot perhaps, but not enough of them, I don't think, that really make that. You can go to a Benedictine monastery perhaps. There are a few corners of the world where the great tradition of humanistic learning in a really spiritually live way survive. We have to become such a corner. And that's the kind of thing I've tried to do in teaching rabbinical students in a vital and personal and renewing way. And of course that means a combination of male and female and classically, quote unquote, male and female energies at the same time. Sometimes those are overly stereotyped. But I think we have in some ways a great opportunity here. Because in the Western university world, the teaching of the humanities really in a way that educates the full human being and that keeps that connection to the tree of life present is being quickly diminished and lost for a series of historical reasons I don't have to talk about. And I think we still have a vital learning tradition. We still have a tradition, if we do it right, of learning and life being combined, of and so on, and to really build a spiritual community around learning, but a learning that has everything to do with love and with awe and with creating a certain kind of human being, learning that cultivates the human being. And I think we have to pick up that task and in some ways help preserve it for a world in which it's being quickly abandoned. I'm sorry, there are too many other questions there I can't get to.
I will also speak. I'll take your invitation to that.
Yes.
As you said, we can't change what was written before, but I love the quote that you wrote, that you said that we need to preach about it. Mm-hmm. And even when we study texts, Zoharic texts, and even Tikkun Ezra, which is Hachi Chashuv Lo, is the Shechina. But it's a Shechina from, as you said, the male teaching the male. And what is interesting in the world is like most of the, let's say I'm now mid-50s, and most of the people my age are like almost the oldest Torah teachers that they are, female Torah teachers that they are. So who do we have which are older women teachers? These are women who did not train through learning text or from within, even not in the university. Mm-hmm. We had artists. Like in Jewish Renewal, before we had Smicha, we had Eshet Chazon, the whole thing of women of inspiration. So we did have artists, and we had somebody very exceptional who was a teacher of Kabbalah from outside everything, which was Madame Colette Abulkar-Muscat, who was older than all of my teachers.
Some of her students are in the room.
Yes, but she was completely outside the box. She had her own lineage. So we had those few women. Most of them were secret, but really, the first woman in Israel to lead Talmud learning is Vered Noam, who studied in high school with me. So if we have now people who are teaching now, Ruth Calderon and the Melila, and we look at those who are teaching in America, they're all mostly women, haven't touched 60 yet, okay? So, and none of us started in Cheder. Some of us grew up Orthodox in religious girls' school, but we were not, let's say, I went to school, we asked to study Talmud, they wouldn't let us. Okay, they wouldn't let us study Talmud. Of course, those who studied in a secular school, there wasn't even an option. So we are starting. So what's happening, like me being a woman sitting next to a distinguished older rabbi on the stage, it wasn't possible. There was nobody who would be invited, nobody who could have that kind of conversation. What's going to happen is like, because we are here, and because you are here, because you are a student, right, of spirituality, then people like Rabat, who would be always, would be generally teaching with men and speaking with men, now he's speaking with women. And that is asking, now with women, asking different questions. So I was just thinking, in Erev Tisha B'Av, Rabbah, newly minted Rabbah Melanie Landau, was going to have a session about how do we break down the metaphors of the battered woman as Jerusalem in Eicha. Now that's Eicha, Megillat Eicha. We cannot change what's written there, and Hechaita Lezona and Davine, Nida, and all those things. But what do we do with that? So it took a woman to start those questions, but it's not only the woman who's going to answer. It's all also going to be the women and the men. So I think when we get to in 30, 40 years, we're going to have old sage women who we've been like living Torah for 50 years. And if we wait a little bit more, we would have girls who were thinking when they were 9, when I grew up, I might want to be a rabbi. Like, when I start thinking about it in my 40s, it was like weird. But so this, I think it will change the Shekhinah, the way we see the Shekhinah, the way we write about the Shekhinah, and we will be having the text to wrestle with, and we'll be preaching. We'll definitely be preaching. And that kind of conversation is a step. A step opening up that kind of possibilities.
I just want to add one more word. It's wonderful, I agree. It takes time.
Yeah.
It needs patience. The change in deep mythological structures does not happen overnight. Some people want to come in and say, all right, we'll write the book, and from now on we will all think this way. And that it just doesn't happen like that. So I think it does need a generation or two or more of people who are deeply rooted in the sources and yet deeply asking these questions, and the change has to emerge in a somewhat natural way.
Okay, Ephraim.
So to answer your question about something that failed,
I would say
wild liturgical experimentation.
Early, give us an concrete example.
Well, early first year of Chavurat Shalom, when we started the Chavurah, you couldn't have a Shabbat morning service without Stravinsky playing in the background, and E. Cummings, I thank you God for this most amazing day, replacing Yotzer Or and the incredible string band playing, and some of that was what we call Shacharit, because we didn't know that the old language worked for us anymore. We somehow assumed it didn't. And therefore, you had to begin with a kind of radical new departure. This was the late 1960s, and felt that was what you had to do. I remember a conversation with Zalman after a year of that, when he said, oh my God, they're going to kill Davnin. And we somehow realized that the power of the antiquity, the power of the echo chamber that this old tefillah had, was so great, we would never be able to create it with this pastiche of modern Jewish and non-Jewish and sometimes our own poetry. And so we began to step back from that very radical place, and except where it really offended us, except where really some of the places we did. I'm not saying we could go back to say Shlo Asani Yisha or Shlo Asani Goy, things like that, which really offended us, we couldn't say. But I would say we moved back to a much more traditional liturgy than I would have expected, more quickly. I remember we had a wonderful lecture come in by a professor, late professor at Brandeis, named Alan Grossman, talking about poetry and liturgy. And he talked about the power of poetry being in its newness, that a poet has captured a new moment and a new idea in a way that gives you a kind of dramatic entry into his or her soul. And liturgy is powerful precisely because of its familiarity, precisely because it's the same thing you said yesterday or last week, and you know it by heart, and yet can discover something new within it all the time. But it's the familiarity that lends it its power. And I think realizing that and coming to terms with that was a very important growing up process for us as a community.
Your name, where you're from?
I'm Leah. I grew up in Kansas City, but I live in London now. My question, I guess, is kind of naive sounding, and it's also grim, which is unfortunate after so many things that have been so exciting. But you were talking about the situation here, and I guess this is just where I'm sitting right now. I think where a lot of people are sitting. And my question, I guess, is just why are the Jewish people not crying out louder? Because I don't really feel that on any kind. I do in kind of some subterranean level, but not in a way that comforts me, I guess, or that makes me feel that we are in any way in the right place. I guess that's a very open way.
Well, it's not supposed to be a political evening, and I won't say too much, but let me say that it's very complicated. We are a very traumatized people in this generation. When we still have Holocaust survivors living among us, that memory and that nightmare does not leave us easily, and politicians also use that and build on it and increase it and pass it on to the next generation, which I think is very dangerous and disgraceful, because they don't feel that we love Israel enough to keep it going, so they have to make it out of fear. They have to play on our fears. I think that's there. But that said, there's always great teamwork between the most extreme Arabs and the most extreme Jews. So Hamas and Noor HaGvaot play off against each other. You know, they combine to make it possible to go anywhere. So I don't want to by any means say all the responsibility is on our side. And I think there is something terrifying about what's going on in the broader Middle East right now. That also makes it a very difficult time, and a time when Jews are naturally going to go into a fearful defensive place. So then it becomes, whether in your synagogue back home or here in the Knesset or wherever it is, who are you? How dare you say you want to take risks with Jewish lives? And I think that instinct, which does have to do with a very long history, and especially with Holocaust memory and so on, is there. And I think it gets blown out of proportion. And I had just telling somebody a little while ago about an odd experience I had last year. We get a call in Boston from the Federation people saying there's a group of Israeli soldiers who have come to America and they want to meet with people all over the country. May they come to Hebrew College and meet with students. They are here because it's Yom HaShoah. So we're always happy to meet young Israelis. They come, and I say, Mapitov, you're here for Yom HaShoah. Why don't you go for Yom HaTzmaut? Yom HaTzmaut would make sense to have Israelis. No, we are sent here by the army because we are here to help prevent the next Shoah.
What?
I said, thank you very much. Bizarre. There's sort of bizarre planning of some publicist in the army who decided we should send young people to the diaspora soldiers to reassure them that the coming Shoah is not going to happen because we are there to defend them. So that's the kind of madness, I think, that built this.
Yes,
my name is David Meir Epstein, and you mentioned the Chabura in the 60s. In the early 70s, I was a member of Chaburat Aviv in Cleveland, and in the late 70s of Chaburat Shalom in Boston. The context in which you mentioned the Chabura was in experimenting and then drawing back. And I'm curious to know how you view the Chabura movement and experience, which was now 45, 50 years ago, can you believe it, and its impact now. Was it a passing phase that, kind of happened in one small generation, or has it had a major impact on the we are today?
I would say the American synagogue has changed a great deal in the last 50 years. How much we had to do with that is very hard to measure. The synagogue is no longer a place where men have to come in ties and jackets on Friday night or Shabbat morning, or women have to be part of a fashion show. Most synagogues I go to are very informal, welcoming places. There are many, many synagogues that have gotten rid of their fixed seats, and people sit in circles, and rabbis and cantors and others strive to create a greater sense of intimacy, warmth, participation. That's very different than the high church synagogue of the 1950s and 60s. Now, how has that happened? You can say we became more comfortably American. That's part of our assimilation. We didn't have to stand up and have declarative, responsive reading voices and say thee and thou to show we were real Americans. We could speak like the Quakers. We were the last ones to still say thee and thou in the course of liturgy. So you can say that's part of the generation. But I think the Chavura, and especially the example of the Chavurot, did have a good deal to do with it. The bringing of Chavurot into synagogues, which was started by people like Harold Schulweis. Just was missing Harold Schulweis and Denny Elkins. I was thinking of that were the first people to do it in conventional synagogues. Around the same time we started was very important. If I have any regrets about the Chavura movement, it's that we were such purists, we wouldn't really publicize the thing and go on campaigns to try to get people to build and create Chavura, because we believe a true Chavura must come out of the needs of the particular group that's doing it and so on. And we at Chavurat Shalom said, we will not be the Holy Mother Church of Chavurot. We don't want to do that because that will be inauthentic. And I think probably a little less authenticity might have been a good idea in that particular matter. But yes, that's true. I think we've had a good deal of effect on the community, but it's a little bit hard to measure.
Please move it.
I'm Laura Geller. I'm the rabbi of one of those synagogues in Los Angeles. And I think for sure the Chavura movement has had a huge impact on North American synagogues, on liberal synagogues. And one of the ways that has happened, actually, ironically, given what you were saying tonight, has been through liturgical reform. That people, many American Jews, meet divinity or spirituality in their, you know, mainstream reform and conservative synagogues, and because of liturgical reform, maybe some of the things that began in the Reconstructionist prayer book have enabled that process. And we know now that there is a new machzor coming out of the conservative movement. The reform movement now is out, and this year will be the first year that it'll actually be used. So given your need for a Jewish language, which is the language of traditional prayer, and the need for innovation, how do you think about these liturgical, these new experiments?
I'm all for lots of things that are not for me. I understand that. Most people don't have my needs because they didn't grow up in my grandparents' shul. And they didn't hear the chazan whose voice cracked every time he sang Al Tashlichenu Leit Zikna An Yantuf, and I know that. And you know, I am the Jew I am because of a series of emotional attachments and a body of knowledge that 99% or better of American Jews don't have, and therefore they have different liturgical needs than I do. But I'm all for them. I'm all for letting 10,000 flowers bloom, and I think there are lots of different things we have to do in liturgy. I think the only way to go with the synagogue today is a kind of multiplex approach, where you have a liturgy that still has some kind of davening to it, and you have a liturgy that's mostly silence, and you have a liturgy that uses creative music and jazz motifs and so on, and you let people decide what speaks to them. That will work. I think we can do that within the context of the same synagogue, and I would encourage people to move from one to the other and to learn more. But yes, I think a variety of all those things happen. Should happen, and those sidurim, I must say, the new conservative machzor that our friend Eddie Feld edited, now completing the sidur, is a marvelous tool, because of the number of reflections and meditative pieces that are added, and things to think about and things to sort of do soul exercises on, and the new reform liturgy is the same way. And there's been a tremendous progress in really trying to create liturgical works that reflect seeker-friendly Judaism, reflect and welcome that quest. So I think that's terrific. No, I'm all for it, even though I'm probably not going to wind up davening one of those books.
I just want to say in a short hara that what we're dealing here with Israel is completely different because of language. Like, people here do understand the Hebrew.
Good news or bad news?
Sometimes it's good news, sometimes it's bad news. It's like, and also because Hebrew is a gendered language, so whatever you like you're so nicely gloss over in English, you go back to the Hebrew and you're stuck. Or not, and then you have to make a change. And it's, so there's all kind of experimentation happening here. What makes it more difficult here is that we don't have a lot of reform conservative shuls, like tons and tons and tons of shuls who are actually interested in creating those different machzorim. And it's a very different experimentation that happens here than what can happen. You have, in a way, you have more freedom to do things there.
We can take one more question.
Yes,
that's
the time. We're getting to the holy hour and a half talk. So do we have the last
the last very inspiring question to help Arthur finish his.
That puts you on the spot.
Your name, where are you from?
My name is Michael, I'm from Richmond, Virginia. So my question is related to a question that was asked before and something that you spoke on the part of the lecture that I heard, like studying with some kids before I came. I'm wondering, how does Eretz Yisrael, Medinat Yisrael, factor into your theology? And what theology would you advocate for both the American Jewish community and the Israeli Jewish community to move forward in a healthy way with Jewish power?
That's a light question.
In 2 seconds,
I don't do that, as you know, Mike. there are too many questions there. Eretz Yisrael, Medinat Yisrael are very different things. I believe in Kedushat HaAretz. I also believe Kedushat HaAretz, like all Kedushot, is meant to be a dugma. A very favorite passage in the Sfas Emes for me, which he repeats a number of times, says everything. He quotes a famous halakhic principle: everything that was part of a klal became an exception to a klal, didn't become an exception just to teach about itself, but to teach about the whole klal. Eretz Yisrael is bichlal haaretzot. It came out of the cloud being holy to teach you about the holiness of land. Teach you how all lands are holy. You have to have the dugma. You have to have Kedushat Shabbat to teach you what a holy day is. But then that holy day has to be a model for how you treat days. So how you treat lands. So I think we have to learn from Kedushat Eretz Yisrael. But I also am watching the various back to the land projects going on among North American Jews. Adama, urban Adama, Jewish farm schools, Jewish farm camps, and so on, and seeing very interesting things happening and things that I embrace. And so, yes, Kedushat HaAretz, but Kedushat HaAretz paradigmatic. I do not have much room for the state in my theology. I have a lot of room for the Jewish people, and Ahavat Yisrael is terribly important to me. I am tremendously enthusiastic about what has happened in this country. Shivat Zion and Kibbutz Galuyot feels in some ways miraculous, although I am not a person who would say in any simplistic way that, yes, God did this, God intervened in history and made it happen. Once I say that in 1948, then I am stuck on 1945, and so I cannot do that simplistically. On the other hand, to say that there is nothing that is supernatural or fulfillment of prophecy about what's happened here would be to put on blinders. You have to say there is something going on here that is at very least magnificent and wondrous. And somehow that means for me, that's what I mean by touched by the divine hand. That to me does not extend to the state itself. I am very worried about making states sacred. I do not like the chief rabbinate's prayer about Medinat Yisrael Reshit Smichot Gulatenu. One could say if they had said Shivat Zion, I might have said yes, but that the Medina is holy is something, is a place where I part company with what's usually called religious Zionism. In that sense, my Zionism, which is very firm, still remains partly secular. I'm a religious Jew and a partly secular Zionist when it comes to the state. Not when it comes to Shivat Zion, but at the state I see as a secular instrument and a very badly debased secular instrument right now. And so I'm quite wary of it. I do not have a theology of the Jewish state, and I don't think I want to. That's a sour note to end on. Something.
Without a question, I would like just to invite you to finish your talk with us with a few sentences of inspiration.
You don't want me to sing a nigun, but I'll. One day I was leading davening as I sometimes did at Chavurat Shalom. And somebody came in, a visitor who was a trained music teacher. She came up to me after davening and said, "Where did you ever get that idea to lead davening in atonal chanting?" And then I knew what I was doing. I had a word for it.
This is one experimentation that worked.
That's an experiment that worked. Yes, indeed. Maybe I'll just say something I learned from my things. Something I learned from a teacher. I want to tell you the most important thing I learned from Heschel, among the many, many things I learned from studying with him and from reading him and from teaching him over the course of 50 years. I once heard him say this Torah Shebaal Peh. Heschel said, "Why is the Torah so concerned with idolatry? So if God, if you make an image of God, you make a pesel, and God has no image, like the Rambam says, well, God has no image, ain lo dmut haguf, so it's a theological mistake. So why is making an image of God such a big sin that it should be the second commandment and so on?" He said, it's not because God has no image. It's because God has an image. You are that image. Every human being is the image of God, but the only medium in which you can make the image of God is the medium of your entire life. To take anything less than a full, living, breathing human being, a piece of canvas or a piece of marble, and to say that's the image of God, is lima'et adamut, is to lessen the divine image. So this work of helping people make the image of God, make the image of God in the way they live, make the image of God in the way they treat each other, and going back to Ben Azai, making that sense of the divine image the very basis of what we do as Jews and the kind of Yiddishkeit and the kind of interpersonal relations we want to have with one another, that to me is pretty much, as the book title says, the heart of the matter. Thank you all for coming.